And now it's time for Power of Prophecy with your host, former professor at the University of Texas at Austin, career United States Air Force officer, and best-selling author, Tex Mars.
Friends, this is Tex Mars. Welcome to another edition of Power of Prophecy, being heard around the world on Worldwide Christian Radio out of Nashville, Tennessee. But we're here in Austin, Texas, and we're also being heard, of course, on the American Voice Network and through a streaming audio on powerofprophecy.com. You can hear us 24 hours a day. You know, if you get up, you can't sleep at night, you got insomnia, well, you're going to listen to a good radio program. That's the thing to do. Just turn to powerofprophecy.com and we'll be on with this week's program. And by the way, this week's program is going to be a good one because a very good friend of mine, you know, Pat Shannon is his name. And some of you may know that name. I suspect many of you do. But he was at our conference. We had a, we gave it some kind of official name. What was it? Liberty and Truth Conference. Okay. Liberty and Truth. Hey, you can't beat those two names, can you? Liberty and Truth Conference, and very popular speaker, Pat Shannon. I talked to him a long time ago first when he was one of the, I don't know if you call it, ace reporter. I'll ask him his official title. Ace reporter or whatever, investigator for Media Bypass magazine. But he's been around a long time. He's written many things. He's with American Free Press newspaper now. And does a great job with them. I always look for the, I guess you call it the byline, you know, who writes the article. And if it's one by Pat Shannon, you know it's going to be sort of, you know, the inside stuff. That's what I like about Pat Shannon because he's one of those inquiring people. You know, he asks questions. Let me tell you a little bit about him. I've already told you, of course, but he has a new book out. I like it because it's sort of a pieces of all kind of things that, you know, a guy like Pat Shannon, who's quite brilliant, as I said, has one of those inquiring minds. And I like the title right away. I'm going to ask him when we get him on in just a minute what about this title. It goes this way. It says, "Everything they ever told me was a lie." Everything they ever told me was a lie. And this is just volume one, so I suspect he's got more volumes to come. But we want to talk about this volume. Now, you'll want to get a pencil. Or a pen and some paper, if you haven't got our phone number and all memorized, because I want to tell you how to get a copy of this book. And you're going to want it too, by the way, because it's packed with information. And before we get my good friend Pat Shannon on, that sounds Irish or what is that? Well, I'll find out from Pat directly. We'll get from not the horse's mouth, but the computer's brain or something that he would have. But I'll tell you, if you look at the table of contents here, man, he talks about money and banking, Barack Obama, who he calls a usurper. I like that old. That's a good old name, usurper. Franklin Roosevelt, Social Security. Well, they certainly want to shaft the working man today and cut out Social Security, which may not be a bad idea. I might accept that so many people have paid in all their lives, and now they want to steal it from you. I'll ask Pat Shannon about that. You know, George Herbert Walker Bush seems to have had some connection with the yokel that shot Ronald Reagan. Maybe some of you don't remember that. Remember Ronald Reagan, he told his wife Nancy he forgot to duck the bullet. But anyway, then there's Tim McVeigh. What really happened in Oklahoma City? The murder of Vince Foster. Hey, I like the old ones, though. JFK assassination. Who really killed John F. Kennedy? And Pat Shannon is one of the legitimate authorities on this subject. So I'll probably take a little time if we can about that. George Wallace. You know, I never voted for George Wallace, but I always sort of, he was sort of a curmudgeon. I know you're probably out there saying, oh, he was a racist and all that. Well, he may have been, but on the other hand, he had a lot of good points too. And boy, he had the establishment worried. And the question is, who really shot George Wallace? When we get JFK, of course, there's the question, the eternal question of Lee Harvey Oswald. And then we get to the most current events, the murder, and that's what Pat Shannon says. He has a whole section in here, the murder of Pat Tillman, Robert F. Kennedy, 9/11. Was it an inside job? So you see, this is like 20 books in one. Pat Shannon, welcome to Power of Prophecy.
How are you, sir? Good to be with you.
Hey, great to be with you, Pat. And, you know, I've never been disappointed in your work. I'm not disappointed here. And you've got everything. In fact, I've just turned to page 97, just thumbing through, and there's the moon landing. Did we really land on the moon? But first, let's just ask about Pat Shannon. Who really is Pat Shannon? I've told him a little bit about you and the fact that I like you a lot. I hope that has some standing with my audience. But what do you mean everything they ever told me was a lie? What would cause a man like you, a very brilliant guy, and I don't mind saying that, it is true. I met you. I know how intelligent and what a great investigative reporter you are. What are you talking about? What impel or compels you? Or not impel. What got you into this subject in the first place many years ago?
Well, right. It goes my research goes all the way back to the Kennedy assassination. I was a young adult at the time, and I took a great interest in the case. As you know, you're old enough to remember the Kennedy assassination as an adult, too. I've already figured out you and I are about the same age. And, you know, if you think back, though, Tex, we all had questions about that. We could not quite swallow this government story about this lone nut. But we had no other information, if you remember. I mean, the media were so cooperative with the whole cover-up and Hoover and the FBI that we had nothing else to go on until private investigators are the ones who really have, over the last 45 years, have turned up the truth in the Kennedy assassination, as you well know. But I read a book in about April or May of 64, a few months after the assassination, and it was called Who Killed Kennedy? By a man named Thomas Buchanan, and I never heard of him before or since. I don't know if he ever wrote anything else. And he didn't have any great earth-shaking answers to the situation, but he had some wonderful, penetrating questions. And he got my attention, and then in September of that year, when the Warren omission came out, I was hooked. I was hooked forever then, and today I guess I probably have one of the largest collections in the country on the Kennedy stuff, just because I've always saved everything I ever had, and it fills up a giant bookshelf of mine with, I got videotapes, I got magazines and Collier's and Look and Life and all those from the era, And I became what others might call a JFK assassination buff. But along with that, then, followed the Martin Luther King assassination and then the RFK, and all these things just stank to high heaven. And the longer I was hanging around as an amateur sleuth, the more I was bursting open with this information, I was about to implode. So I had to start writing. But it was about 20 years down the road into the early 80s before I really got into it professionally, and that was with the Gordon Call situation in North Dakota and Arkansas. And that's the one that many people don't even remember now outside of our reading audience, like at AFP, because we've kept up with it for a long, long time, most of it since it happened. But that was when the U.S. Marshals literally attempted to murder a United States citizen in North Dakota, but they picked on the wrong guy. And he took out a couple of them and wounded about three others, and he even made an escape through the fog. It was almost like a godsend. It reminded me of the story of George Washington in New York when the fog set in, when he was trapped by the British. God sent a fog for him to cover up his men. He was able to sail across the Hudson River there and get out. And this is the same thing happened with Gordon. And he escaped to Arkansas, and then later the marshals and the FBI tracked him down and literally did murder him, shot him in the back of the head, and then tried to claim that there was a shootout with officers. So anyway, with that sort of stuff brewing in my country, I was about to blow up. If I didn't start writing, I was probably going to implode. All this stuff inside my head.
Well, you know, I know these things are mysterious. They're curious. And you're a person that questions the official accounts because you've seen the lies. You know, after all, your book is entitled Everything They Ever Told Me Was a Lie. But is a little bit of it too, Pat, that you have some kind of a built-in truth-o-meter or something? I don't know what you'd call it. I think God puts in some of us. And we just can't stand the lie. We can't stand the hypocrisy of the liars. And we want the truth to come out. And, you know, I think it's so important, you know, even in the scriptures, Jesus is called many wonderful things, you know, counselor and all those things, king, majestic. But he says he's the way, the life, and the truth. The truth. And to me, I see your book as a book of truth, that you are really a discoverer. You know, you're sort of like a Christopher Columbus, but it's a discovery of truth, isn't it?
Yes, and, you know, it's kind of amusing that you would ask me about that title. I want to tell you where the title actually came from. As I just said, this sort of stuff had been building up within me for a long time, and I've been putting it on paper for about over 20 years. But I had not really compiled this book. I kind of thought about doing something like this, of putting together a whole book of government lies and cover-ups. But back about 04 or 05, a friend of mine, he was a lawyer type, one who had resigned from the Bar Association because he couldn't stomach that, but was still able to practice and fight the IRS. And he was a real thorn in the side of the IRS over here in Atlanta. And they finally trumped up some charges on him to get rid of him. And he ended up going to Atlanta Federal Pen for about 3 years and as a what I call a political prisoner. And, of course, there are more political prisoners in there than real criminals. But his wife, the couple were good friends of mine and close friends and still are. And she lived in Georgia, and she would go visit him every week, and I was in Mississippi at the time and talking with her on the phone and trying to give her all the support I could. But one time we were on the phone, and she told me that there was another fellow over there who was like in his 50s and he was from Chicago, but had also been a thorn in the side of the government and exposing so many things that they finally put him in jail for. Well, you know how it is with the so-called patriot prisoners. Most of them haven't harmed anyone, but the government's afraid of them.
Oh, sure.
And here, she was in the waiting room, waiting to see her husband, Ken, and there, this man's father. He's 80-something years old. He was a World War II veteran. I think he was in the islands in the South Pacific, and, of course, had a few medals to go with that, but just about as red, white, and blue as you could get. And Donna had met him a few weeks or months before in the past when he'd come from Illinois to visit his son, and there he was in the waiting room again as they both waited to see their loved ones come out. They got to talking, and she told me that with a little wistful tear in his eye, he looked at her and he said, "You know, everything they ever told me was a lie."
Mm. Yeah.
I said, Donna, what a title for a book.
Mm.
And so the title for my book text was born actually before any of the text was.
Well, you know, maybe the only title I've seen better than that is I was at a bookstore, and I guess, you know, as I was passing through the psychology section, they have all these relationship books, you know, written by, you know, I don't know, gals, psychologists and all, talking about dating and marital situations and all that. But one of them was entitled, I guess it was a book about, you know, a woman complaining about men or something, but the name of it was Hello, He Lied. So I thought, you know, that was from the moment she met the guy, hello, he lied even about that. So I don't know how you can lie about saying hello, but I didn't know what the book was all about. I sort of figured from the cover and all. But I said, well, that's a pretty good title. Hello, He Lied. Lied from the very beginning. Well, you know, what is the government lying about? You know, there are a lot of people out there that question Tex Mars or Pat Shannon. Well, why would the government want to lie to us, Pat? I mean, don't they want America to be successful? Don't they want the economy to be smooth? Don't they want people to have freedom and liberty according to the Constitution? Why would they want to lie to us? How do you answer people that really are just sort of ignorant? But, you know, they're kind, they're good people. They really don't know.
You know, right there in the introduction of my book, I think I defined that, and I wasn't smart to think of it, but old John Birdman Bryant defined it for me. He said, you know, you don't have to cover up any falsehoods. They only have to cover up truth.
Hmm.
Now, I thought that was a pretty powerful statement. And if you stop and think about it, of course, it's only the truth that they cover up. They don't need to cover up lies. They use them to cover up truth.
That's
so we go all the way back to Well, Pearl Harbor, we could start with it. We could go back a lot farther than that. We could go back to John Wilkes Booth and Abraham Lincoln, and how the government protected Booth after the murder. Of course, Pearl Harbor, volumes have been written now about how Roosevelt and his cronies all knew about the attack on Pearl Harbor. In fact, they intentionally provoked it because they needed a war at that time. The military-industrial complex, of course. Now we got, Lyndon Johnson in the Gulf of Tonkin. Your time in the military was a result of that, I'm sure. A total blatant lie, an attack in the Gulf on American ships that never happened. So it just goes on and on and on. The intriguing things to me that I guess will always give me a marketplace for every volume I want to write on this subject are the assassinations, because almost all of them are politically motivated, and almost every one of them has a lie behind it. If you mentioned George Wallace. Well, how did Arthur Bremer shoot Wallace four times and three other people with a five-shot weapon?
Mm.
It goes on and on and on. So I guess now I'm my eye and ears are trained maybe a little bit better than the normal reader to sniff out baloney when I see it on the television or in the newspapers.
Some things are just so blatant. I remember the Sirhan thing. In your book, you talk about Robert Kennedy. If you read the newspapers right after Robert Kennedy's shooting in that hotel kitchen where he'd just spoken there in California, it appeared that Sirhan was quoted, you know how that goes, as saying he did it because Robert Kennedy was favorable to Israel. And Sirhan was an Arab and a Muslim, and so, he thought that the Kennedys were pro-Israel, pro-Zionist. But in fact, we know now that the Kennedys were not pro-Israel. Probably, given Michael Collins Piper and other good books, we know now that in fact the Prime Minister of Israel hated Kennedy's guts, and that Kennedy had basically told Israel, you're going to have to get rid of your nuclear weapons. And Israel was furious that America was going to make them cough up all the military, the nuclear weapons that they had stolen from us with the Israeli American spies. But in any case, none of that was true. All of these things, the same thing about Lee Harvey Oswald, the cover story they had made up that he was a Fidel Castro Soviet spy. They do go to a lot of work, though, don't they, to create cover stories?
Well, yeah, and of course, when the patsy is set up, he has no idea it's being a patsy. And in this case, of course, as I explained in the book, there was both a Lee Oswald and a Harvey Oswald, and they look so much alike that they were almost twins. Harvey, of course, was not the son of Marguerite, born October 18th, 1939, in New Orleans. And that was one thing that bothered us for a long, long, bothered me for 30 years. How can a kid who grows up in New Orleans, man, at 17, drop out of high school and join the Marines, go to language school for 6 weeks and come out speaking Russian so pristinely that his future wife, Marina, thinks he's a native?
Hmm.
That doesn't happen. You and I both have known immigrants from Hungary and Italy and other foreign Middle European countries that have been in this country for 30 years, and they still have their accent. They don't lose it.
That's so very true.
The same thing if you and I went to Russia and struggling with the language. Well, the difference was that Harvey Oswald, as uncovered by John Armstrong in his great book, Lee and Harvey, and as I was explaining to your group down in Austin last April, this man was born of Russian parents, raised in New York City, and of course grew up speaking Russian fluently. That was the answer. It took us 30 years to discover it. And of course, I can't take any credit for that. John Armstrong did the most indefatigable research anybody, I think, has ever done in history.
Just an off question, and I know it's not the whole focus of the JFK thing, but I always had I don't know if you'd call it a sympathy, maybe it is just plain sympathy, for Marguerite Oswald, the mother of Lee Harvey Oswald. Somebody sent me a little booklet. It wasn't a well-done booklet, but it had pictures of the funeral of Lee Harvey Oswald. And nobody, you know, nobody showed up. They couldn't even, they finally got a minister to agree to come and have a graveside ceremony. And I think there was only four or five people there, and that included a couple of Secret Service agents. But she was.
And they had even had to use some newspaper reporters to as pallbearers because they couldn't find six people who would.
Exactly. And she was such a pathetic figure. But she had always said, you know, my son was a patriot. He was a good American. He didn't do this. And boy, she got such scathing criticism. You know, the press acted as if she had done it herself, that she had killed the president. And all she was is a bereaved, weeping mother. Of Lee Harvey Oswald, who himself was shot. How did you see that? Do you think she knew at all what her son was involved in?
Well, yes, that mother did. That was the mother of Harvey, who was killed by Jack Ruby.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and Armstrong points out that not only did they bring these two together in the eighth grade in junior high school, they went to different junior high schools in New Orleans, but he found people who knew them both. And so when one joins the Marines, the other does too. And they were melded, melded together somewhere around 1958, and Lee actually kind of disappeared through the cracks of the CIA, and Harvey emerged as the one.
Hmm. Well, that whole thing, how do you, I know there's so many people involved, from the FBI to LBJ. Basically, in a nutshell, if I could ask you in a minute, who killed JFK? And I know you know so much, you could speak for 20 hours, and it'd be fun to hear it, and intriguing. But in a nutshell, who really killed John F. Kennedy?
Who was the trigger man? I don't think anybody knows. You know, there's one man in named James Files in Stateville in Joliet, Illinois, and serving life for murder. Who claims he did it? He says he was the one behind the fence there at the Grassy Knoll. There was Roscoe White, who appeared about 15 years ago. You remember the Dallas policeman whose son had him surface, and he claimed to have been one of them. I don't think we will know, and I'm not even sure, except for maybe James Files, if even of the others know who actually killed Kennedy, because there were so many bullets flying around Dealey Plaza that day. There were various assassination teams. I wrote about Russell Bowen, the CIA colonel, who had flown, as he described it, the triangular assassination team into town on Thursday the 21st, and he was at Clint Murchison's house for that big party in Powwow with everybody from D.C. who was not a Kennedyite was there, and that's when Lyndon told his girlfriend, Madeline Duncan Brown, that after tomorrow, those blankety-blank Kennedys will never embarrass me again.
Mm. You know, there's a very sleazy audio tape that the LBJ Library released, about 5 years ago. You're probably aware of it. Of LBJ, while he was in the White House, you know, after he'd become president, and of course, he was involved in the murder of John F. Kennedy, but he called on the phone to Jackie Kennedy and invited her to come to the White House. And it was very clear that he was trying to seduce the woman. To me, I mean, he was just using, I don't know, he didn't say it come out right, but he was saying, why don't you come up and see me? And why don't you, it was, I don't know. Some people would say, oh, he was just being nice to her as the widow. But I don't know if you've listened to that tape, but he was a very sleazy, sordid character, Lyndon Johnson, wasn't he?
That's about as accurate as I could describe him.
Yeah.
Sleazy and sordid.
Yeah.
See, he's tied to six other murders in Texas.
Oh, that's true. That one guy got shot. He killed himself by shooting himself in the back, what, 31 times?
Barr McClellan, whose son is Scott, who was George Bush II's press secretary. Barr is a friend of mine, and he wrote a book maybe 7 or 8 years ago on which implicates Lyndon, of course, and the whole JFK thing. And he's a retired lawyer now who's was in a law firm, the Austin law firm, matter of fact. What was that guy's name? Clark, was it? That was LBJ's...
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, my wife, Wanda, worked at that law firm.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. She was an executive assistant to one of the guys there that was of counsel that was the man you're talking about, the LBJ's sidekick, yep. who they say really ran the state of Texas secretly, and Clark was his name.
Yeah, I think it was Clark.
I mean, LBJ,
I'm going to be checking up on her then. We may implicate her in this.
Implicate my wife, Wanda. Well, she was executive assistant to a guy who was there, a lawyer, who was the head of the Board of Regents of the University of Texas system, you know, all of its universities and lands and all that. But her best friend was the secretary to a Clark. And I didn't even realize it at the time, but we'd go out to dinner with them and we would get to talking about, you know, the law firm. It was one of the biggest in Austin at the time. I think at the time it had about 70 lawyers or something. That was before Austin became a bigger city. Anyway, that was all an interesting thing, but Wanda would tell me how powerful that law firm is. And, you know, that sort of went over my head. I was teaching at the University of Texas for the Air Force. And in fact, the other gal, the secretary to Clark, and when I say secretary, I mean a little bit more than secretary, if you know what I mean. I mean, she'd been there many years, very trusted, very high paid, more, personal assistant. And I don't mean sexual at all. I mean, you know, professional. Thing. But I remember when Clark died, she had written instructions from him what to do with all the papers and all that kind of stuff. But sort of an interesting thing. But Wanda told me at the time that he was very powerful and knew LBJ and could get things done anytime with a phone call. So you never know where you're going to meet people. But my wife, you know, now after the fact. I look back now and remember, those statements. But now let's look at another guy involved in the JFK thing. E. Howard Hunt. We only have about a minute and a half to the break, here. E. Howard Hunt supposedly on his deathbed, you know, the former, CIA operative involved in Watergate, he admitted to being involved, in the, conspiracy to kill JFK. Is that true?
We don't know to what degree. That is true. In fact, some of the independent investigators deeper into this subject over the years than even I've been have already discounted much of that story. But I'm not sure. I'm almost certain that Hunt, yes, was involved to a point. Was he one of the three tramps who you know one of them looks exactly like him? Remember the three tramps that were. Photographed,
yeah,
coming out the railroad track.
Uh huh.
And while they were marched into the police, the problem was they all had neat, cleanly shined shoes, even though their clothes looked like some railroad tramps. They were pulled off the railroad car by the cops, and here they are walking them to the police station. They stayed in there a couple of hours. They were never booked, and their names were never put down on any official record, or if they were destroyed. And it was many years later before, like up into the 80s when these pictures were appearing that some of them came forward and said, no, that's not Hunt, that's me, and this sort of thing. So I don't know if that part is true. I don't know how much of what Hunt's so-called deathbed confession, is true. Once again, goes back to the summation I made a few minutes ago. There were bullets flying all over Dealey Plaza. I think there were several assassination teams there, and that's the way they always do it, Tex.
Well, they wanted to make sure they got him.
Seems to be sure the job gets done.
Wow. That's you know, when we come back, I want to ask you about Jack Ruby. The story that he visited his rabbi, and they say he really was not even a synagogue goer, at the local synagogue in Dallas. I wonder if there wasn't some plotting going on there at the synagogue that involved the Israeli Mossad. And I'd like to ask you about Jack Ruby and his connection with the mafia, maybe with the Mossad as well, and much more. Your book has so much more than just JFK. So, again, my guest today is Pat Shannon. We're talking about his outstanding book, Everything They Ever Told Me Was a Lie. I'm Tex Marr. Stay with us. This is Power of Prophecy. Hello, Tex Marr's back again. And, you know, I would want to let you know how to get this book for yourself. I spent the last week, boy, what a busy week. I was a little bit ill too, but every time I had an opportunity, I kept this over at my chair where I sit in the family room, and I go back and grab this book. And the nice thing about it is it's got a lot of different sections. You know, Pat Shannon, the author, just talked about the two Oswalds. And then here's a section, the murder of Corporal Pat Tillman. The murder. You know, the NFL football star that went over to Afghanistan. We're going to ask Pat about that when we come back in a minute. And then there's so many cases. The MLK, Martin Luther King assassination, the Robert F. Kennedy. And he has some little insights and information that you won't find anywhere else about Robert F. Kennedy and the gun that supposedly did the damage. So we'll ask him about that. 9/11, most of you out there know that it was an inside job, but there's some little different aspects here that covered by Pat. Franklin Roosevelt, he's considered, you know, the second coming of Jesus Christ. Ronald Reagan says Roosevelt was a great man. Reagan's supposed to be the great communicator who was a Republican. Let me clear my throat when I say that. That may just be one of those lies that people talked about, that Reagan was a conservative. Was he really a conservative? I recently saw Newt Gingrich saying that really the greatness of America was, you know, at hand when Franklin Roosevelt was president. But wasn't Newt Gingrich, isn't he supposed to be a conservative Republican? And wasn't Roosevelt a socialist Democrat, maybe even to the left of Barack Obama? Well, so much is in this book, including Barack Obama, the usurper. He's a usurper. Shouldn't even be president. Not qualified by the Constitution. There's a lot of things Pat Shannon says here about that, too. So you'll want to order this book for yourself. Let me tell you a little bit about it. It's, 280 pages or so. We do ask $25 for the book. $25. Please add $5 shipping and handling. If you'd like the book by Pat Shannon, Everything They Ever Told Me Was a Lie. Now, when you call us on our toll-free number, 1-800-234-9673, to order the book, you can just say, hey, I want that book by Pat Shannon. That's pretty easy. Or I want the book about everything being a lie. We'll know what you're talking about. We have some pretty intelligent folks here that handle the phones, and they know about each of our books. You're not calling to New Delhi, India, or whatever. When you order our stuff, you get our folks right here, of good American citizens, taking your order, so you don't have to worry about that. Everything They Ever Told Me Was a Lie by Pat Shannon. 280 pages or so, including the footnotes and the references. Again, $25, $5 shipping and handling. You know, we've got a cold winter coming on. That's what the experts say. They're usually wrong, but let's just give them credit. Every once in a while, they're right. They say this is going to be colder than usual. You want a book to, you know, cuddle up with by the fireplace, or pull the blankets over you a little bit, turn on the reading lamp light and read, this is a good one. I think you'll enjoy it, and you can read different sections because there's so many in here, and you'll come out knowing a lot more. And boy, you'll sure have some things to talk about over Thanksgiving and Christmas. When the folks come, New Year's Day dinner, you'll say, hey, I was just reading this great book by Pat Shannon. Everything They Ever Told Me Was a Lie. And you can discuss it. That's how I always get arguments and brickbats thrown and things like that at my dinners. Wanda says, shut up, Tex. Don't talk about religion or politics. But I do anyway. I can't help myself. All right. And I'm sure Pat Shannon's that way too. All right. The book, again, $25, $5 shipping and handling. That'll take care of it. And you know what we do with the money we make here? Well, we don't make any, but what we get in, we spend. We spend on our newsletter, on our websites. We preach the gospel and the truth around the world. Of course, we have our videos and books, and we have our facility here. And we're going to keep telling the truth until one of two things happens. Either, well, they assassinate me, or Jesus comes, or I die, just to natural causes. Whichever comes first. And I'm willing for any of those three things to happen. But I'm not going to, you know, volunteer for anything except when Jesus comes. I'll volunteer for that one. All right. So other than that, we're going to be here. We've been here, by the way. Let's see. Jerry, he's my broadcast engineer. How long have we been in business? The mystery. Almost 20, 5 years. You know, I was on a talk show just recently, and the guy called in. He said, "How do we know you're not some disinfo information specialist? You know, a guy like you just suddenly surfacing? You know, I'd never heard of you before." Well, okay, you never heard of me, but the ministry has been here 25 years. And at this particular location, I guess we've been here about 16, 17 years. And let me give you the address, folks, to order the book. That is Power of Prophecy, or text Mars at 1708 Patterson Road, Patterson Road, Austin, Texas, 78733. You can order the book by going to our website. You'll see it pictured with a little description of it and all, telling you some more about it, right on our homepage, powerofprophecy.com. And you can use your PayPal or charge card and order it through our website. Okay? So three ways to order. You can call us toll-free, 1-800-234-9673, or our website, powerofprophecy.com, or 1708 Patterson Road, Austin, Texas, 78733. And be sure to put Republic of Texas. No, don't do that. Don't do that. No, yeah. Don't do that. That'll just get you your letter or whatever mixed up. We do call ourselves the Republic of Texas. We love America, too. But if we can't change it, I'm willing to be a republic some way or other. Maybe the Republic of Galveston Island or something. I don't know what, but we're going to have to do something, aren't we? Secede, whatever it takes. Hopefully, though, we can win America back. Maybe that's a question I'll ask Pat Shannon. He knows a lot. Maybe he'll have an opinion on that. Okay, let's return to our regular program. I'm Tex Mars, my guest today, Pat Shannon, ace reporter, investigator, really one of America's premier investigators into assassinations of JFK, MLK, RFK. Boy, what will Obama be? It'll be Barack Obama, the B.O., assassin. I don't know what that would be, or the Barry Sotero. Pat Shannon, welcome back to Power Prophecy.
Thank you, Tex. Thank you.
What would we call Barack Obama? I'm not advocating assassination by any means, but if it were to happen, some dirty folks did it, would that be the BOS or the BS or the BO or what?
Yeah, the assassination of BS. Yeah,
right. Yeah. That's going to be a tough one to come up with. Well,
I don't think that they're going to even bother with anything that drastic with him, because he's actually committing political suicide. In fact, one guy today I've just read is suggesting that perhaps the Democrats will not even run him in 2012. That would be a first.
You know, it seems like he's just happy playing golf and flying around in his airplane, seeing important people overseas. It seems like he's enjoying himself. It's like one big vacation for him.
Yeah, well, I know I certainly would be.
Yeah, there you go. Absolutely. Well, of course, the country is going to the dogs, but it seems like it's been going that way for a while. Let's talk a little bit quickly about Jack Ruby. Now, Ruby wasn't his real name, was it?
Jacob Rubenstein. He was born in 1910. Was actually a wheelman for Al Capone in Chicago in 1929 when he was 19 years old.
Now, what's a wheelman?
He drove Al
Capone. Oh, a wheelman. Yeah, now that makes sense. Okay.
Yeah. And migrated to Dallas right after the war, as I recall. I don't have any notes in front of me, but I think it was 1947, and of course he opened the Carousel Club sometime there in the 50s. And my friend Madeline Duncan Brown, who's deceased now, who was Lyndon Johnson's paramour and bore his illegitimate son in 1950, she knew Jack very well. She told me that she used to hang out down at the Carousel Club when she was younger and like to play cards down there with the girls. And so she knew Jack well. And in fact, when the district attorney and this would have been Sunday afternoon after the assassination on Friday, she and several of her lady friends were sitting around the living room watching the TV and watching all the goings on. And of course, Ruby had killed Harvey by this time. And so on comes the district attorney there and some one of the newsmen. That was back when they could ask questions whenever they wanted to. Asked him, he said, did you know Jack Ruby? And he kind of raised his eyebrows and looked at the ceiling for a moment and thought. And he said, no, I don't believe I did. And Madeline told me they all fell out laughing because he hung out at the Harrisville Club. Jack Ruby knew everybody on the police force, and had anything to do with the judiciary, he was always down there bailing somebody out. He knew them all, so she just thought it was hilarious when the district attorney said, no, he couldn't place him.
You know, that name, Jacob Rubenstein, apparently the Jewish mafia actually ran the Italian mafia, always has. And from what I understand, you know, one of the little errands that Jacob Rubenstein did, and they even made a movie, you know, named Ruby about him on HBO, was he flew over illegally to Cuba to talk to Castro about the possibility of them opening up the casinos again. So he was,
I think he was involved in gun running as well.
Ah, gun running.
Castro. Earlier, but as far as his tie-in with the mafia and potentially or probably rather of the Mossad, you know, CIA works, FBI and CIA work the same way all the time. They never use their own people in the serious stuff because they don't want them to get caught in case they get caught. So it's always contract killers.
Yeah.
Well, that's what the mob is made for, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, they're full of contract killers. And so the fact that, you know, people say, well, did the mob do it? Well, there might have been some mobsters behind the fence doing the shooting, but certainly they, you know, weren't the brains of the outfit.
Yeah.
But there was, and what I was getting to, there were several phone calls from Ruby's telephone to and from Ruby's telephone from beginning Friday afternoon and Friday night through Sunday morning when he shot Oswald to Chicago. And they tied those into a lot of other mob leaders. He was taking instruction from somebody above.
Oh, absolutely. They must have convinced Ruby that they would get him off of it, maybe declare him temporarily insane or something. But for some reason or another, he thought he would probably get off of this, right?
Yes.
Get out of it. And do you think they murdered him in his prison cell?
I don't think the mob did, but it was very strange that he didn't come down with cancer. There was no diagnosis whatsoever of cancer until his appeal was allowed. When he got his case reversed, a lot of people don't remember that, but it was in early 67, he was going back for a new trial. This spelled trouble for the cover-up artist.
Now, he asked the Warren Commission, Gerald Ford, you know, the crumb that was the head of it and all. He said, if you can just get me out of this city, out of this jail here in Dallas, get me to Washington, D.C., where I can tell you the truth. But here I can't. He was basically saying they'll kill me. But they evidently didn't want to hear the truth, did they? They would not let him out of that jail.
Well, I think he was very naive to even say that, because he also was talking to the real killers. They get him in Washington, they're going to take care of him, too. You can bet on that.
Yeah, maybe he was hoping that maybe only one or two of them, you know, was maybe Boggs or Congressman Boggs, who turned up missing later on himself, you know, in Alaska, the airplane going down. Well, let's switch subjects to something a little bit more updated. Pat Tillman. Here's a guy, very handsome, NFL star, million-dollar man in football, but he wanted to be a patriot, evidently, and volunteered for Afghanistan, going to fight the terrorists that had blown up 9/11, the buildings and all there, World Trade Center. And so something terribly wrong happened, and he ends up dead over in Afghanistan, but not from the hands of terrorists or the Al-Qaeda or the Taliban, but from Americans, apparently, or at least friendly forces. How do you see all of that? What does your book say about Pat Tillman?
Well, first of all, the title, Everything They Ever Told Me Was a Lie, fits this Tillman case better than any other chapter in there, because it is almost literally everything in the case. First of all, you know, Tillman gets killed, and he was the poster boy for the Bush War. I mean, he was their hero. You know, as you just said, he gave up a lucrative NFL contract. His brother was in the service, and he had what I call he contracted a case of red, white, and blue fever. And and that's defined in the book, as you saw, but when he got over to Afghanistan, he found out that this thing, he wasn't protecting America, but he was protecting the drugs, the poppy fields of Afghanistan, which the Bush family and others were had a very lucrative take on. And he began to correspond with a liberal columnist, Noam Chomsky, and he had told Chomsky that when he got home, he was going to blow the whistle on this through him. He was going to be able to put, give Chomsky the whole inside scoop. And what the powers that be were discovering was that Pat Tillman was about to become the poster boy for the anti-war group rather than the warmongers.
He was going to be Cindy Sheehan, but with credentials, huh?
Yeah. And he, but first, like I say, everything they told us was a lie text. First, they told us he was killed in a shootout, and he was a hero, and he did a great thing. And they even sent his mother a silver star, you know, posthumously for her. Mm. I mean, what a slap in the face.
Oh, yeah.
And then later down the road, we discover that, oh, he was killed by friendly fire. Oh, could it have been a flagging? Well, no. And so that got tossed around. Well, fortunately, his mother was pretty dogmatic on the whole subject, and she would not turn it loose. She wouldn't give up. And she kept after it. And writing to the generals and writing to congressmen and just pursuing this truth for literally over the next couple of years and or three, really. In about 07 is when it started to appear that not only was Pat Tillman not killed in any shootout with the enemy, but he was also not killed by friendly fire. He was killed by unfriendly fire, probably a CIA hit. And doctors said that he was shot through the head through a blast of a quick automatic weapon from as little as 10 yards away, 10 to 30 yards.
Boy.
So if he's there with his platoon, text, there had to be several witnesses. There are some of those boys know exactly what happened, and I'm sure they're terrified to say it.
Sure. You know, one of the problems he may have had was writing to a guy like Noam Chomsky. You know, I can't say for sure. I don't have the evidence. Let me say it up front. But being a liberal, he's, you know, to me, he's one of these guys that, well, let's just say that to me, he's a big fake and a hoax. But that's my opinion.
Oh, right. But nevertheless, he would have influence, we know, with the media. And Tillman was going to be on his side. That was the point.
Well, maybe so, although I think Chomsky will do anything for Israel. You know, being Jewish, he's going to be for Israel, and it's always made me very interesting that all of the NBC, ABC, CBS, CNN, they were always so anti-war against the Vietnam War. But with the Bush War, and, of course, became Bush, Clinton, Obama, whoever it was involved in Middle East wars, they've always been for that. Anything that it will help Israel, they're Israel firsters, the media want to do, and I think that's Chomsky too, just like Chomsky cannot believe that Israel or the Mossad would be involved in 9/11. So Chomsky, no, I think he's just a big Jewish hoax. And it would not surprise me, although I have no proof that he's connected with Israel or the Mossad. Yeah. But again, I don't have the evidence, but looking at his behavior, conduct, and favoritism, let's just say, toward Israel, I wouldn't trust anything of Chomsky. But evidently, on the other hand, maybe they were just going through Tillman's mail. Certainly they would probably, if Chomsky is legitimate, they would be going through his mail and see what Pat Tillman was up to. Boy, that would have been a big blow to the Bush War, now the Obama War in Afghanistan, if Pat Tillman had come back and campaigned and told the truth about those heroin poppy fields, wouldn't it?
Oh, yeah, and I think probably the coup de grace, as far as Mary Tillman, his mother's investigation went, was when she finally reached General Wesley Clark. It was about as big a name as you can get in the military today, and he came forward. I'm reading to you now from page 209, a quick quote. He came forward to publicly confirm that there was never any evidence of accidental friendly fire being responsible for the death of Tillman, and that Army medical examiners concluded Tillman was shot with a three-shot burst to the head from just 10 yards away. Clark concluded that, quote, orders came from the very top.
Wow.
Murder former NFL star because they feared he was about to become an anti-war political icon.
And now Wesley Clark.
The very top means the White House.
Yeah, it does. And, you know, Wesley Clark, General Wesley Clark, has pretty well become persona non grata to the establishment now, hasn't he?
Yeah. He has been quiet. I don't know where he is.
Yeah, well, you know, he was even being touted for president for a while, but now if he, you know, did this, they're trying to get the guy's name out away from everybody. Oh, let's go to another thing. You know, there was an interesting movie some years ago that a good friend of ours, and I'm really being tongue in cheek now, who's the guy in Southern California? O.J. Simpson.
Oh.
starred in that, I forget the name of it, but it was, I think it was, do you remember that?
Capricorn.
Yeah, Capricorn. That basically, you know, was supposedly fiction movie, but the movie's plot was that they filmed the whole thing at a, you know, remote Air Force base in a great big airplane hangar, filmed the whole moon landing there. But it appears like movies.
Area 51 in Nevada, Texas.
There you go. Okay, thank you. It seems like movies might somehow become true.
Oh, I think they do all the time. You remember the one about 10 years ago called Wag the Dog?
Oh, yes.
That was perfectly timed with Clinton's problems with Monica and the Senate hearings and stuff. It was perfectly timed to distract from that. It became a real a dog wagging. But incidentally, they do this all the time, often before the fact. Now, of course, that Capricorn movie with O.J. and the Area 51 thing didn't come out until the early 80s or maybe 79, as I remember. In fact, I was telling somebody not long ago that I wanted to see if I could find that and rent it again. I would like to watch that because I did see it in the theater 25 years ago, but I'd like to see it again. But anyway, yes, this indeed, that is the way they do that. And by that time, you see, 10 years after the alleged moon landing was when skeptics were starting to appear. And Bill Kasing, that I wrote about, was the first one that got my attention. He wrote a book called We Never Went to the Moon.
Mm-hmm.
And I was absolutely flabbergasted. I said, holy smokes, they fooled us with this. The more I got into it, it was much like the Thomas Buchanan book, the first book on the Kennedy assassination. He didn't answer many questions, but he sure had a lot of them. And it got our attention. Well, meanwhile, one of the astronauts, he's in the book, his name escapes me, Jim Lovell. Jim Lovell called Kasing a kook. Well, Kasing came back then and sued him for defamation of character or whatever, and it mysteriously got dismissed from federal court without comment.
Mm-hmm.
See, that's the power behind the throne. I mean, they couldn't have Lovell stepped right into the trap. Can you imagine him being on the witness stand under oath?
Oh, yeah.
That was exactly what Kasing wanted.
Well, the whole thing in 1969, it was such a dramatic. I remember staying up that night, and it was like 2 or 3 in the morning, you know, when they finally landed and Armstrong made his famous statement, you know, one step for mankind, one giant leap for mankind. Of course, that in itself is sort of a New World Order psychology statement. But it was so esoteric, ethereal, let's just say unreal.
Yeah.
And you know, even now, they recently announced, Obama announced that they have canceled plans to return to the moon. So think of all the technology we've had. I remember all the computers. You know, we didn't even have personal computers back then in 1969. All the technology we've got, but they're still unable to land another man on the moon.
Right.
And here it's been, what, 40 years, 4 decades, and they're still not able to go back. But what an incredible technological event to go there 40 years ago that somehow cannot be duplicated.
I remember the next morning talking to a friend of mine downtown in Gulfport, Mississippi at the bank, and I said, did you watch Fantasy World last night? And that's what we thought of. It was Fantasy World.
Fantasy.
And it wasn't, I didn't disbelieve it. I really thought it had happened, and I did for 20 years.
Well, you know, maybe they should have talked about Fantasy. Remember the old Fantasy Island show? And Ricardo Montalban, the little bitty dwarf guy?
Yeah.
Herb, whatever. That would have been
the plan.
Yeah, exactly. Maybe that's what should have happened when Neil Armstrong landed. You know, Ricardo Montalban, welcome to Fantasy World of the Moon. That would have been a great one. Well, they missed out on something there. Well, let's get to RFK. We're running out of time here. You have so much in your book. RFK, there's an interesting, even the guy's name that shot him, Sirhan Sirhan, who has two names? But you say there's some hanky-panky that happened there, too.
Oh, there was terrible hanky-panky in that case. LAPD behaved as rottenly as the FBI had in Dallas. The whole thing was a cover-up from the start. What we learned in later investigation, much too late, was that the 8-shot Ivor Johnson .22 revolver, I knew the gun very well. I was in Sydney, Australia that night in '68, And I just happened to be down at the Sydney Morning Herald when the first teletype came across. That was back in the teletype days. And shots were fired in the Ambassador Hotel ballroom where Bobby Kennedy was speaking tonight. I tore it off the teletype. I still have it in my scrapbook. I saved it. And that's before we knew any of the, you know, that he was even dead. But the Ivor Johnson pistol I knew very well because I owned the same gun. I was a nightclub entertainer back in the 60s, and I used to get paid off in cash on Saturday night. So I just, you know, I carried a little 22 revolver for close range protection. And so it was exact same gun that an 8-shot Ivor Johnson that Sir Han had. However, it wasn't proven until 1971 when Ted Chirac, an investigative reporter, got a ballistics expert, and they proved that none, not a one, of the bullets fired from Sirhan's weapon hit Bobby Kennedy.
Wow.
And, of course, there were 11 bullet holes in the room, and he had an 8-shot weapon, so we knew somebody else had been firing. And then later on, they discovered two more, decided there were 13 bullet holes in the room and people. But Kennedy was killed, and Thomas Noguchi, the medical examiner from Los Angeles, said that there were powder burns behind his ear on two separate shots, and the gun would have had to bend from 1 to 3 inches away when it was fired. It was probably fired by the security guard who was marching next to him. One witness, a CBS reporter, saw the security guard kneeling, draw his gun, and fire.
Hmm.
But they poo-pooed him right out the door. They didn't let him even testify about this anywhere. But he's still maintaining his story. And shots were fired that went through Kennedy's coat, missed his body, but went through the tuft of his coat under the armpit, ended up in the ceiling. The shots in the head were on an upward angle, and another shot hit him in the back was at an upward angle. So it was pretty good circumstantial evidence, at least, that the man was kneeling and shooting Kennedy from the backside, and it was probably the security guard named Gene Caesar.
You know, interesting fact, now I may have something that you don't know, and that's very rare about these assassinations, but of course I've always studied the secret societies for many years. There's a Rosicrucian group out in California. In fact, I just visited the Rosicrucian Museum when I was in Santa Clara 6 months ago or so. But, you know, Sirhan, they found all of this Rosicrucian literature, and he had evidently joined the Rosicrucians, they claimed, had all this literature in his apartment. And then some years ago, I found out, and I actually have somewhere in my files, I don't know where, newspaper clipping, that the Rosicrucian Museum had a big dispute between its founder and its board of directors and all kinds of things. Anyway, it ended up in court out in California. Turns out that Ted Kennedy, was a member of the board of directors of the Rosicrucians. And he was called, subpoenaed for the trial that happened about what happened to the money of the group or something. But the whole thing that Ted Kennedy would be somehow involved with the Rosicrucians, which, as you know, back to old Pope John, back in the 60s, he was rumored to be a Rosicrucian, as have many Catholic cardinals and popes. But somehow there's some connection there. I don't know what, but I thought I'd pass it on. And you know what? We've run out of time here, Pat.
Oh, okay. Well, I was going to tell you some important things about Sirhan, but we'll have to do it next time.
We will. We'll have to. We've got so much to cover here. The book is Everything They Ever Told Me Was a Lie by one of America's premier investigators. His name, of course, Pat Shannon. Good friend of mine, really a knowledgeable person, an honest man. And you have to sometimes get a lamp like Diogenes did and go looking for those kind of guys late at night. But right here in the daytime, we've had Pat Shannon. Pat, thank you for being our guest.
Well, thank you for having me, and I want to look forward to seeing you again sometime soon somewhere.
Hey, give Willis Carto a hello for me. I greatly appreciate what y'all are doing, American Free Press, all the folks there. Please give them our best, would you?
I certainly will. Thank you.
All right. God bless you, Pat.
You too.
Thank you. This is Tex Mar. It's been so great being with you today with my guest, Pat Shannon. And it's my fervent prayer that you'll tune in, dear friends, each week and discover the power of prophecy.